This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Right, so we've got a bunch of things to review. Dark Knight's not one of them.
No, it's not, because Dark Knight's not out until... I'm seeing Dark Knight on Friday. I know that somebody has been on the radio already who has seen it and apparently was very excited about it. I mean, I'm looking forward to it enormously because, funnily enough, here's an interesting thing. When I was reviewing Hancock, I said... The big problem with these comic book movies is that what happens is they start doing something interesting, but then they kind of give up, and they think in the end they have to descend into all this sort of, you know, nonsensical robots hitting each other because that's what they have to do. And I said, you know, of course, the only exception that proves this is the Christopher Nolan Batman movie, which is absolutely great and never descends into that. Somebody posted a response to that, which said very authoritatively, and I stand corrected, they said, actually, if you go back to your review, what you said about Christopher Nolan was that the movie was pretty spectacular, except at the very end when they did descend into some action stuff, which was clearly there to sell it to that crowd. So I stand corrected on what I myself said, which is a peculiar position to be in. Yes, I've corrected myself, which is slightly different.
No, you've corrected you yourself.
I've corrected me, myself, and I.
Sebin,
so thank you for that.
About scientists being given a huge grant at the beginning of the film rather than being threatened with being shut down.
Yes, because this was because we said, is there any other kind of scientist in a movie other than the one who starts off with their entire laboratory being threatened with being shutting down as at the beginning of Journey to the Centre of the Earth?
Sebin Trowbridge says, what about Jurassic Park? Which is, does that
work? Oh, well, oddly enough, the case in Jurassic Park is that he's gone off and made his own arrangements, hasn't he? That's the point. He's set up his own theme park, because he's sort of outside of the establishment. He doesn't have a laboratory. He is a multi-millionaire who has gone off and made his own theme park.
So it doesn't apply?
No, I mean, it's a good example, but that I think he comes under the mad scientist role there.
Who don't, by and large, apply for funding.
No, which is different. What we're talking about is, you know, a lab situation in which there's a scientist in the lab, and they're always threatened with being closed down, whether it's Arnold Schwarzenegger in that film in which he gets pregnant rather than Emma Thompson. That always is the case.
P.S. says, Seb, looking forward to seeing The Good Doctor with his band at the weekend and his talk with Nick Rogue.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is the Llama Tree Festival, so we're playing on Saturday. Then I'm doing on stage with Nick Rogue on Sunday, which would be great for me, because, you know, I'm a big Nick Rogue fan. And so he's going there to talk.
Where are you on the bill?
What, you mean with me and Nick Rogue?
No, you and the band.
Oh, well, it's not a bill, Simon, it's a festival. You know, everyone's equal.
I think the fine festivals have bills.
Do they?
Either top of the bill or your bottom of the bill.
Well, I don't think we're top of the bill by quite some way, but I don't think we're bottom banana either.
So we'll try and get round to Donkey Punch and meet Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Should we do Meet Dave?
We should do Meet Dave, because it's the new Eddie Murphy movie. And the worst thing is that my kids have been seeing the adverts for it on television and saying, can we go and see Meet Dave? It looks really funny.
Wall-E as well.
That's where
coming
we're
up. Let's do a box office top 10 first of all. The Mist is at 10. Before you go any further, Dave in Manchester. Dear Indian Short Round, on The Good Doctor's recommendation.
Short this, stuff, isn't it?
I'm just reading out. This week's cinema outing took us to see The Mist. And fantastic it was too, having been enigmatically promised the bleakest of bleak endings. It certainly didn't disappoint.
Very good.
It was also perhaps grimly comic. The hopeless irony of those final few minutes was such that one couldn't help but raise a smile, despite their horrifying nature.
Exactly.
So it's horrifying, it's grim, it's bleak, but hey, it puts a smile in your face. Whilst, he continues...
Puts a smile in your face?
No.
Anyway. Generally, the smile is on your face, but in your case, it might be different.
In your face, which is biologically...
An in-your-face smile.
Whilst this film has much more going for it than simply the shock of those last moments, including standout turns from Toby Jones and William Sadler,
yes,
as much social commentary as you care to read into the storyline, and a nice array of satisfyingly squirm-inducing beasties, mm-hmm, the end is so memorable, and in keeping with the film's tone, that the fact the studio actually wanted to change it makes one wonder whether the suits know what they're doing at all. Presumably... they would have argued it would be better off come the closing credits if Jeff Goldblum found a cure for his insectoid affliction. Donald Sutherland really did find his daughter running through the tunnels of the Venetian canals, and a recently retired Harrison Ford and Sean Young could just drive off into the sunset.
Very good, very good. So what three films were those references to, Simon? No, I know, don't look at it. No, you're cheating off the top of your head.
No, I'm just, well, The Fly.
Yeah, and?
Harrison Ford's that last one.
What?
Indiana Jones.
No, Harrison Ford and Sean Young. What does Sean Young fly off into the sunset
in
Indiana Jones?
He's in the UFO.
Blade Runner. P-Brain.
And it's that Venetian thing with Donald Sutherland.
Yeah, go on. Donald Sutherland running around Venice. Little girl in the red dress.
I can't remember.
Eyes Wide Open.
Is it Eyes Wide Open?
No! That's a clue. Eyes Wide Open.
Don't Look Now.
Well done.
That was painful.
Never do spontaneous questions. It's no good. Adulthood's at 9.
Which is not as good as kidulthood, but as I've said on several occasions, I do think that Noel Clarke has better work ahead of him.
Sex and the City at 8.
I'm glad to see it's on its way out. I'm glad to see that that what was formerly a deluge of emails from people with qualifications saying they'd seen it has now trickled out as well. I don't think... Have we got any spectacularly qualified people this week who have enjoyed it?
Well, what's happening is that, in general, all the correspondents now just have... Whatever it is, people are just putting their degrees down.
Oh, good. I think that's a very good thing.
But not just doing that, but also saying what grade they got.
Oh, I've got a pile here. I'll give you that.
Nick Foster, for example, brackets MA, RCA, BSc and ONS.
MA...
Matthew in Huddersfield, Bachelor of Engineering and Master of Sciences and Master of Philosophy. I mean, I don't know what they're trying to prove. Also, you could just add it. They might just be making that up.
What, like you made your one up after it was given to you as a giveaway?
No, I think I didn't make it up. I was given one.
Yeah. You were given it. You didn't actually do anything for it.
No, but it's not the same as making it up.
It's pretty much the same as making it up.
I have a certificate and I wore a gown. What more do you want? Mm. Wanted at 7.
Yeah, unwanted. I mean, it's quite nice to see James McAvoy doing an A-list action movie, but it's such a stupid action movie, and it is one of those really weird cases of a movie in which, you know, the sex is all to do with the gunplay, and it's directed by the guy who directed Night Watch and Day Watch, and it don't make no sense whatsoever. And Angelina Jolie just goes back, because it's funny, because she did some brilliant stuff. I mean, she did A Mighty Heart, in which she was absolutely terrific and she really demonstrated that she could act. Now in this, she just goes back to doing that thing that she did in Beowulf, which is being pneumatic and pouting a lot.
How are you pneumatic? What do you have to do to be pneumatic?
Well, I mean, exactly as it sounds. I mean, she looks like she's been inflated.
Yes. Is that just lips, do you think, or just inflated?
No, it's everything
all over
about her. It's everything. Like she's not, you know, she's not like a real person. She's like a, you know, a walking sofa. It's very strange.
The Forbidden Kingdom at 6. You make her sound like something from World of Leather.
Well, did you see Beowulf?
Yeah, I did.
Well,
yeah.
Exactly.
That was quite fun.
Yeah, she was the only cloven-hoofed and high-heeled Grendel's mother. What was the one that we just done?
The Forbidden Kingdom?
Yeah, that's the one in which we had Jackie Chan and Jet Li together at last. Sadly, they come together under the sort of auspices of this rather cheesy Hollywood movie that was described by its writer as Kung Fu Wizard of Oz, which sounds to me like a great movie. Unfortunately, it's not Kung Fu Wizard of Oz. It's a bit monkey, and it's a bit Bride with White Hair, and it's a bit Drunken Master, and it's a bit all those other things. But in the end, it's really sort of Kung Fu Kid light. And it's a shame, because I would have liked it to have been so much better, because I do really like Jackie Chan. I think Jackie Chan is a really likable screen presence, but he doesn't have much to like in this.
Journey to the Centre of the Earth at number 4.
Journey to the misspelt Centre of the Earth, as opposed to the Centre
of the
Earth.
Every time I go past that poster,
it's going to bother you.
Bad font, bad spelling.
Yeah. But have you seen the film?
No. I've heard the trailer, though, last week. Very good.
Yes, 3D. And because we are now in the 3D revolution, we are assured that what's going to happen is that by 2008? By 2011, it's something like 1 in 3 major release movies are meant to be in 3D. I mean, I have to say, I remain sceptical about this, because I think in the end, flat screen, there's something right about flat screen format. 3D is a weird format, but Journey to the Centre of the Earth is really good.
You say there's something right. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that there's a reason. Can I explain this properly?
Well, briefly.
Okay, when cinema started, the screen was what we call Academy ratio.
Too long already.
No, I'll be quick, right? Okay. It started boxy shaped like that, right? Okay? Mm-hmm. And then it sort of got wider. It didn't get taller, it got wider. It went out to 185, well, it went 166, then it went to 185. And then it went out to 235, which is cinema scope, which actually is pretty wide. And then it kind of settled back to some extent to 185. And if you now look at the dimensions of a television at home, they're 16x9, which is 177. Okay, you're getting this? One up to 177.
Oh, I'm very sorry I asked about this. Did it go to 275 and 285?
No. That was Capital Radio, wasn't it? Was that Radio 1?
It was Radio 1,
sorry. There is something about the dimensions, and please, I would invite correspondents to this. There is something about the dimensions of a screen, which is 185 by 1, okay, 185 along, 1, and flat, that just works for the human brain.
Kung
and
Fu.
When you start doing other things about it, like IMAX, it's all very impressive, but IMAX is a peculiar ratio. It's too tall. And, you know, Cinerama, it's interesting for 2001, but it doesn't really work.
Kung
for
Fu
the movies,
Panda at 3.
Which I saw in IMAX, and I thought it was interesting, but rather too tall. Do you see how I did that?
Very good. Yeah. I like that. I appreciate it. Hancock's at 2. Mm-hmm. Mamma Mia at number 1. Now, Mike in Dublin, BA, HDip, Ed. So what's that? Higher Diploma of Education, I imagine. to go with his Bachelor of Arts. Mike in Dublin, rather disappointing, not telling us what grade he got. So no. Maybe
are
just
we doing grades?
Well, some of them are. Yeah, absolutely. And if you've got ons, everyone's putting ons in there. Dear Pinky and Perky, really enjoyed the Doctor's review of Mamma Mia, although I have no intention of going to watch it, as it sounds truly hideous. As regards finding a name for Sienna Miller, which was last week, as well, may I suggest the name Sienna Filler? Although I have a feeling this might have already been used.
No, sure. It's all right. It's not... The thing with IKEA Knightley is it was so brilliant. I think we're going to be hard pressed to top that.
Robin Redding, dear Simon and Kermode, it says, on the subject of movie mashups, here's one that doubles as a review. Throw Mamma Mia from the train.
Very good.
I also meant to contribute to your other games months ago where you deliberately get the name of a film wrong. So we have the Texas Chain Store Manager, which I quite liked. And he puts in, he says, finally an entry for the Sienna Miller name game, Sienna the World as We Know It. Love the show, but more singing, please, and less dancing, says Robin Redding. Dear Shabby and Scooby, or should that be Daphne and Thelma, says Sam Wood in Wokingham. As a regular subscriber to your podcast, alas, unable to listen live due to the horror that is Friday afternoon ballet lessons, school pickup and swimming. I thoroughly enjoyed Mark's review of Mamma Mia and followed your advice to watch said review on YouTube, which is where we put all this stuff. That's why the lights are on. And you can watch it live streamed should you wish. Fantastic to see Mark in action, especially the dancing bit. And even better, I discovered that every week's film reviews and interviews are available to watch in all their live stream glory. This is now beginning to sound suspiciously like a puff it written is. By our advertisers. Department. Thank you.
I must say, I feel that doubling the license fee would be asking too little money.
Sam continues, thank you for providing my evening entertainment over the coming weeks. No need to watch dire summer TV schedules. Bone kickers, anyone? Hugh Bonneville, Adrian Lester, what were you thinking? Well, on the subject of YouTube, can I recommend... Oh, then it goes on quite
I don't think I actually did dance, did I?
Well, you did with your hands.
I danced with my hands?
Yes, because you were basically... In essence, your thoughts on Mamma Mia, it's pretty dreadful, but so much so that it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. And then I danced with my hands while I said that, did I?
Yeah.
I don't remember. Was
a
it
lot
like,
of people...
Was it like that? Okay, fine. That's right.
That little kind of gay that's waltz not, that you
that's
do.
That's not dancing, that's gesticulating.
That's mincing. Okay. Dan,
ooh.
Dear Dr. Kermode, oh, I'm excluded from this. I enjoyed your review of Mamma Mia. I thought I'd share an interesting anecdote since you mentioned you were a fan of ABBA. Björn Ulvaeus began his musical career at 18 when he fronted the Hootenanny Singers, a popular Swedish folk skiffle group. This can't
no.
be right. I heard him talk about this on a recent Swedish podcast about his career. Listen to your show each week from Singapore, says Dan.
The Hootenanny Singers, but how would you say
that? That doesn't
sound right. The Hootenanny Singers.
Well, if you're in a Swedish folk skiffle group, why would you call yourself the Hootenanny Singers?
Well, because it's probably because it's sort of authentic English.
Right.
Does your chewing gum lose its flavour on the bedpost overnight?
That is absolutely that's nonsense. Anyway, Wall-E coming up. Yeah. Some thoughts on that.
And you've seen Wall-E, haven't you?
Yes.
So we can have a two way about it.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Just an early thought. But on the poster, and people were pointing this out last week. On the poster, it looks like the robot from Short Circuit.
It does. It does. And also, on the poster, it looks like the robot from Silent Running, which is a slightly smarter thing to say.
I was just going to say that. Dear Fred and Wilma, some stuff about Kung Fu Panda here. Enjoyed it, despite being an adult. The one thing that puzzled me, this is Lee in Wakefield. Mm. Almost all of the cast were famous people. Jack Black, that Angelina woman, very dramatic. Lucy Liu.
Pulchritudinous also.
Very good. Dustin Hoffman, Jackie Chan, Ian McShane. Why bother? The only one that made any real effort was Jack Black, and I was a little bit distracted by imagining the other actor rather than the character. Anyway, ends up a few more movie mashups. The Dark Nightmare Before the Devil Knows You're Dead Calm, which is quite
that's
good.
That's very good.
The Opposite of Sex in the City of X-Men. Indiana Jones and the Forbidden Kingdom of Heaven Can Wait. John Senior in Tokyo, you've probably got hundreds of these things by now, he says, but how about Who Framed the Picture of Dorian Gray, The Wicker Man in the Mask of Zorro, The Eternal Lightness of Being John Malkovich, Beautiful Creatures from the Black Lagoon, and Raging Bull Durham. Quite good, aren't they?
Raging Bull Durham is the best of it. The simpler they are, the better they are.
Yes, quite like that. Loads more. You're absolutely right, John Senior in Tokyo. We have got hundreds of them, and they're all pretty good. So, we've done the top 10. Amongst the new releases, the one getting most poster space is the new Pixar movie, had Sigourney Weaver on Friday. This is Mark's thought on Wall-E.
Well, let's begin with that pronunciation, because it is one of those titles when you can't say Wall-E, you have to say Wall-E. You do, because it's...
Once you've seen it, you do.
No, but that's it. I mean, even before I'd seen it, people were saying to me, have you seen Wall-E? People can't just say, have you seen Wall-E? Because that's what, you know, Wall-E is the guy with the big nose. He puts his, you know, nose over a wall. Wall-E was here. You know,
where's Wall-E?
Where's Wall-E?
Where's Wall-E? He's going red striped top.
So the story is... the whole of the Earth has been left behind by human people because we have polluted it so badly that it has just become a completely smog-ridden dump. And all life appears to have been abandoned. Everyone's gone up into space and they're all now living in spaceships.
It's a bit like Canvey Island, really. That's what's left.
That's a terrible thing to say about Canvey Island. Dr. Feelgood from Canvey Island.
Oh, I take it back then.
Yeah, exactly. All that we have on the surface of the Earth is a little robot called... Wall-E, which is it's a waste and something, is a waste disposal robot. And what he's doing is he's just going around picking up waste, turning it into a little cuboid box, and then effectively building skyscrapers of waste out of it. And as you can imagine, that being the scenario, there's not much dialogue in the early part of the film. In fact, we had a choice of two clips. This is the one we went for, and this is about as dialogue heavy as it gets. And that's it, really, isn't it? I mean, the whole first section of the movie... Now, later on, when they get into space, you do start having human people talking, but, of course, they aren't as interesting as Wall-E. Now, I want to be quite clear about this. There has been a lot of discussion amongst critical circles about whether or not Wall-E is properly a kid's film. As you probably know, when it opened in America, it opened to rave reviews. I mean, people literally saying it's the first contender for best film for 2009. It's kind of kicking off the Oscar season. So you're not talking about best animated film. You're talking about a contender for best film. Also, a number of the critics who were absolutely raving about it talked about how dark it is. The director has said that the key tone of his original treatment was loneliness. The idea of this lonely little robot alone on this planet just doing this thing. In fact, one of the original taglines was, after years of doing what he does, and he's about to discover what he's for. But there's this sense of just years and years of this little robot doing what he does very quietly. And then he goes back home, and he's got this funny little world that he lives in which he's got an old videotape of Hello Dolly with Michael Crawford. And because I feel very strongly about Hello Dolly anyway, partly because my brother was in a production of it about 2 years ago, so I can't think of it without sort of bursting into tears anyway.
But you cry and everything.
No, I know, but it's, you know, it is...
Was your brother playing the role of Michael Crawford?
He was playing the Walter Matthau role, the other guy, you know, the old curmudgeon, and of course,
so kind of in the kind of DNA,
what do you expect? Yeah. So for the first part of it, this is what you get. Now, it's clear to me that what that is Silent Running. Okay, have you seen Silent Running?
No,
but you know how I feel about Silent Running.
Yes.
Okay.
You feel very passionately about it.
I do.
One of the great movies ever.
Science fiction film from the early 1970s, directed by Doug Trumbull, who did the special effects on 2001. And Trumbull specifically said that he had made Silent Running in response to the lack of humanity of 2001, that he wanted to make a film that actually had humor, had sentimentality in it. And the story in that is this Brewster, all the Earth is completely polluted. There's no vegetation anymore. And the only remaining forests are up in geodesic domes that are wandering around the cosmos, being looked after by little walking robots. And at the very beginning, the spaceships get called back and they all have to be destroyed. There's only one left, and Bruce Dern is on his own with these little walking robots. And in the end, it ends up with a little walking robot tending to a plant. And it clearly looms large in the back of Wall-E. Now, the question is whether or not a kid's audience would get that. Now, I saw Silent Running when I was, I think I must have been 9, and I loved it. I mean, it broke my heart, and I really, really was upset by it. But I thought it was absolutely wonderful. And we should say, right away, if people are going to take their kids to see Wall-E, Wall-E is not doesn't have a downbeat, heartbreaking, melancholy ending. I mean, it does send you out with a big bang and a crash, and it's fine. It doesn't, you know, it ends not with a whimper but a bang, doesn't it?
Well, it finishes with a positive kick.
Exactly, it finishes with a positive kick. Unlike Silent Running, which literally finishes with the little robot on his own drifting off.
Don't spoil
into
it.
No, Silent Running.
I know. Yeah, don't spoil it. I haven't caught up with it yet.
Okay, it's been out for like 35 years.
Still a spoiler.
Okay, fine. So
what happens in... Oh, go on then.
Well, no, I'm not going to tell you what happens in the end of Wall-E. All I'm saying is, because people do want to know, if they take their kids to see movies that people talk about being dark, they want to know whether the kids are going to come out happy or sad. I think it is important to say your kids will come out of it happy. It is rated U for, and I love this, rated U because it contains very mild threat and violence.
Very mild.
It's not just mild threat and violence, but it's very mild threat and violence, okay? So, firstly, parents, you know, be reassured your kids aren't going to come out of it in tears. The question is whether your kids will get bored during that first period in which it is essentially the loneliness of the little robot that, as you pointed out in posters, to some extent evokes Short Circuit and little, you know, lost robots. But I think much closer to E.T. There is a lot of E.T. in Wall-E.
It's is that the eyes?
It's the eyes partly, because the thing about E.T. was he had the great big, you know, the big wide-eyed head, right? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what Wall-E has. And all the expression is in the up and down movement of those mechanical eyes, but it's also to do with the voice. I mean, it's interesting that Wall-E ends on E, and when people say there's all that stuff about E.T. phone home, you know, Deborah Winger, incidentally, Officer and Gentleman, she went from, you know, being whisked off by Richard Gere to going, phone home, E.T. There, fine, okay. There is clearly an oral echo. Don't look at me like I'm mad.
No, it's just I love it when you do voices.
No, but
you, and accents.
Yeah, okay.
And dancing.
Then fine.
It's great.
But you do think, don't you, that there is some E.T. in Wall-E? I'm not just making this up.
No, it's apparent. Yeah, the way it looks.
Great,
a little
fine.
Bit of that.
Big head,
just
funny little squat body, the thing of the extendable neck, all that stuff. My feeling is this. I think that kids are ready for darker and more challenging material than a lot of people think they are ready for. And I think that kids will get Wall-E. And you look at the American box office, it has already, I think it's done something like 160 million, which if anyone's underperforming at 160 million in the US alone in the first 3 weeks, then, you know, that means that basically we're into the realms of astroeconomics, because 160 million is an enormous amount of money. There has been some people have said that they've been at screenings in which kids have got bored at the beginning. I think maybe the very young children who like a lot of knockabout slapstick may find little bits of it slightly slow. But there's plenty of Laurel and Hardy style knockabout slapstick. There's plenty of when he's picking up the rubbish and he picks up the fire extinguisher and he gets blown out of the thing. You know, it's lots of things, dang, bang, crap. But it is very sentimental. But it's very sentimental in a way which really, really appealed to me. And I sat there thinking it's just a very well-made, proper 1970s dystopian science fiction film. When they get out into space, it kind of changes gear slightly. And then it becomes, I mean, it's an eco-friendly film. It's about how we need to get up and do more exercise and we've all abandoned the world and isn't that terrible and we all need to wake up, which very much reminds me of the speech that Bruce Dern gives in Silent Running, in which he says, and you know the problem is, everywhere you go on the Earth, it's 72 degrees. And it's interesting that that turns up in Wall-E. So clearly a debt is owed to Silent Running by this film. I mean, it's kind of acknowledging it. But all the stuff in outer space about the humans just floating around in space on hover chairs and they're all obese and their bones have started to wither because they've been out in zero gravity for such a long time is perhaps slightly less successful. I mean, personally, I could have just had the whole film about Wall-E wandering around on his own on the lonely, desolated planet.
That would have sort of slightly drifted away from it being a nice, happy kids film, though, at that point.
It would have done. And I think that it, actually what they've done is balanced it beautifully in saying, OK, Mark, here's your, you know, anti, you know, your dystopian stuff and your misery and your sadness. And here's the stuff that's actually going to get the rest of the audience in. But I do think it's really good.
Peter in Edinburgh.
Did you like it?
I did. Yeah, no, absolutely, I did like it.
But I just think
I'm not reserved at all. I think it's very good. I just don't think it's Toy Story 2. I don't think kids will go, or even adults will go and say, I have never seen anything like that before.
No, I would agree that it's not Toy Story 2, in that Toy Story 2 is The Godfather 2, and I think we're both agreeing that it is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Toy Story and Toy Story 2 are as near to perfect as it's possible for films to be, like David Cronenberg's Crash. But in the case of Wall-E, I mean, there are things that you could legitimately say, well, you know, it's long and slow and all that sort of thing. But I still think it has a sense of wonderment. I think that the design in it is absolutely beautiful. And I was touched by it. I was genuinely touched by it. And it's amazing how much, I mean, Pixar are very good at this, but how much they get out of something which can't smile and can't speak, how much sense of pathos they get out of that little robot.
Peter in Edinburgh. Dear Punch and Judy, went to see Wall-E at the Edinburgh Film Festival, much like Mark after having seen Mamma Mia. I couldn't remember the last time I left a cinema on such a high. Unlike Mark and his solitary skip down the streets, though, I was clearly not alone in this feeling, as I could see complete strangers walking up to one another and chattering away in dazed excitement. I disagree with Simon's suspicions that children may not find as much to be enchanted by as their parents, a charge which I feel could be levelled at Ratatouille, film featuring little robots.
I agree with that, because I think Ratatouille, I don't like Ratatouille.
Just let me know when I can finish this.
No,
sentence.
You can. I was just agreeing with him.
Is inherently going to appeal more to children than one about rats and cooking, no matter how endearing Pixar managed to make these subjects. And the small child I was sat spent the entire movie eyes agog and mouth agape.
Good.
I truly believe Pixar are among the true visionaries of modern cinema. Who else can make the closing credits, this time offering a lot more than Pixar's well-worn parodic outtakes, one of the highlights of a film? And I can't wait for the film's official release so I can go and see it again.
Good.
Chris, in Enfield, brackets bronze swimming certificate, is the best he can do. Dear Jules et Jim,
I went to
a preview screening of Wall-E on Saturday. Absolutely loved it. Stunning animation and a surprisingly very deep and adult theme underneath the glossy surface. It's also the first summer blockbuster I can recall that hasn't just met my high expectations, but surpassed them. It made me cry three times, despite being completely heartless. Chris is saying he's heartless rather than the film. I trust the good doctor was able to appreciate this amazing achievement after last week's ABBA warping of the brain.
Yeah, no, I was.
And Suzanne, brackets, PhD, BA, ONS, close brackets, dear Dr. Kermode and Simon, I don't quite like that very much. Saw Wall-E at a preview on Sunday. Don't have kids either. Loved it better than Kung Fu Panda. It has pathos, humour.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't even mind being preached at. Save the planet, be green, blah, blah. Long live Stanton and Lasseter. They really get it.
That whole thing about it being preachy. I mean, my only reservation about this is if you're going to preach about it, it's not preachy. What it's saying is, you know, pollution will cause us all to not be able to breathe. Seems fairly true to
me. Bob in Dublin, we sorted something out. He says, dear Nixon and Kissinger, listening to yesterday's interview with Ms. Rebecca Miller, who was on, as in, married to Daniel Day-Lewis.
All right.
She's got a novel out, Torture of Arthur Miller, and so on.
Yeah.
I didn't go on a lot about that when she was here because I thought it might rub her up the wrong way, really. Anyway, I said to her, so, look, there will be blood. Where do you put the emphasis?
Yeah.
Because if you live with Daniel Day-Lewis, you're going to know for certain. So we can't ask Daniel Day-Lewis. He's not yet on our list.
Yeah.
He wants to come on. We're a bit busy.
Okay.
Emphasis on the blood. That's where it is.
There will be blood.
That's what you have to do.
That's from the horse's mouth.
So Bob in Dublin says, Ms. Miller put the stress on blood. Others put it on will or there or even be. And I've overheard on the street people emphasising an implied you, as in you, there will be blood, like some kind of warning. I think at this point Bob is now making it up. But what if there isn't any emphasis and the sentence simply reads in a hurried kind of nonchalant matter-of-fact way, oh yeah, there will be blood. Sure, what else were you expecting? Was that a bit weird?
It was a bit strange, but I'm very interested because I think the biblical thing is there will be blood.
Look,
if she's married to Daniel Day-Lewis and I'm clearly not,
there will be blood.
Then she would know. There will be blood.
And that's as close to the truth as we're going to get for the moment. Movie mashups, Thomas Cosgrove, Reservoir Dog Day of the Dead Man's Chest of Fortune Express. We need to go for the longest ever, because this is getting extraordinary. Galaxy Quest for Fire in the Sky, Captain in the World of Tomorrow Never Dies.
Very good.
I think that is about the longest that we've got so far. On the subject of Wall-E, John in Middlesbrough, Dear Sense and Sensibility, obvious who's who, Simon, solid common sense, Mark, flighty artistic sensibility. Just to lob in a bit of trivia regarding Wall-E, Sigourney Weaver, who adorned last week's podcast, has voiced a ship's computer in at least one previous comedy animation. Perhaps you could offer this as a quiz question for the bad doctor who won't get it.
No, okay, well, the ship's computer in Alien was Mother, and obviously she didn't voice that. So she's voiced a ship's computer in one previous... Is it a spaceship?
The answer, Ms. Weaver played the ship's computer in Futurama, Season 4, Episode 4.
Oh, no, it's television.
And like all good ship's computers, she went berserk and turned off the oxygen.
Fine, doesn't count.
There's lots more there.
Can I do this quickly? Cagney and Lacey, I watched Silent Running on Mark's recommendation. Very good. I must say, I hope I like the wee robot in Wall-E as much as I did like the ones in Silent Running, although I doubt I will, from David. Hello, Siegfried and Roy. Regarding Silent Running, and this is very good, are not the robots called Huey, Dewey and Louie? They are, after they're named, so they're originally Drone 1, Drone 2 and Drone 3. Then they're named Huey, Dewey and Louie. A Disney plug via Pixar from Patrick. And from David, P.S., any film with that dude from The Burbs in is fine by me. That's a Bruce Dern gag.
Dear With Nail and I, normally in a meeting on Friday afternoon, so can't usually listen live. Weird having to hear about traffic accidents. Where's Wall-E is called Where's Waldo in America and Canada, and therefore there seems scant reason for the good doctor to keep saying Wall-E like Tattoo from Fantasy Island. And that's signed Robert Pittenham, M.Phys, brackets, ONS, first class, and studying for a D.Phil in particle physics in Oxford. You can't get cleverer than Robert Pittenham.
No, you can't.
Jake and Elwood love the shows. I'm an expat in Chicago, avidly listening in podcast form. This is Mark Bunch, MBA. He's another one suggesting Sienna McMillan, but we've probably done that.
We've got a couple here suggesting. Have you done Sierra Forda? That's from.
I think I rejected that as not being very funny.
I don't quite get it. Is it a car? Ford Sierra. Sierra Forda. I see it.
That's why you don't read emails. Simon says,
I do. I just given them. I don't, you know.
Well, say no. Just say no.
Okay.
Dave says, do you realise that many of us work-shy employees instantly googled the Hootenanny singers? This is because a previous emailer suggested that Bjorn Ulvaeus had a love of folk skiffle.
He was into Hootenanny. He was enjoying them before
ABBA. Yes, we have all accessed YouTube and seen a 1964 Bjorn singing away in the Hootenanny singers. Voltan says, dear Marquis and Robespierre, I just caught Monsieur Robespierre suggesting that in Jurassic Park, Attenborough's character is not under threat of closure, thus maintaining Kermode's law of mad scientists. Surely it's the Sam Neill character that is under threat of unemployment at the start of the film that then helps him take up Attenborough's offer for funding.
Yes, okay, I'm sorry, you're quite right. For the second time today, although the first one I stand corrected, yes.
Chris in Nottingham says, previous text mentioned the grant successfully awarded to a scientist, Mark Lean incorrectly referred to Dickie Attenborough. Mm. The circumstances that occur at the grant of the film are that the Richard Attenborough character awards a grant to the Sam Neill, Alan Grant character to continue his work in dinosaur digging.
Yeah, but that does mean that my law works, that at the beginning of all films, all scientists are in danger of having their laboratories closed down.
And just squeeze this one in ahead of what's next, by the way.
We're going to do Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Deja Vu, and I'm doing it especially for you.
Excellent. Ian in Chorley, Mark and Simon, rather conventionally. Yeah. A correspondent last week reckoned that the wind in The Happening was a visual... This goes back to Mark's constant...
What's making the wind blow?
...was a visual device and not a real wind at all. This is fair enough, except for the scene where several characters are pinned in the middle of a field by strong gusts of wind.
Yes.
This suggests that either the wind is working in collusion with the plants and trees to kill humans, or M. Night to Remember Shalimar hasn't thought it through. Which might be the latter. Actually, put M. Night... Shyamalan, but M. Night to Remember Shalimar
is better.
Is how he has to be from now on. So, why are we talking about Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young?
Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Deja Vu, which is this film directed by Bernard Shakey, who of course is...
Shaking Stevens?
No, Neil Young. That's the when he directs films, he directs them under the moniker of Bernard Shakey.
This is your new friend, Neil Young.
My new friend, Neil Young, who I went over
thought was rubbish for years.
I thought it was rubbish, I thought it was whiny, nasal, droning noise, and then I saw Heart of Gold, and suddenly I thought, oh my lord, I understand him, it's brilliant. Now, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, I have to say I'm still going to have a harder time with, because I'm not as much a fan of their work by quite some way as I am of Neil doing that sort of more country-inflected stuff that he does in Heart of Gold. But the story is... Neil Young, having written this album of songs about how you know, anti-Bush and anti-war, decides to get all the old cronies together, who all look like assorted trolls and wombles now. I mean, it's just like, one of them literally looks like Orinoco with the big...
Which one's Madame Chollet?
Yes. No, none of them are Madame Chollet. And they decide to go on tour to sing these songs.
Womble
and
songs?
Womble songs. Right? So underground, overground, wombling free, let's get out of Vietnam, not in my name. And because what they're effectively saying is, look, we protested against the Vietnam War, and this is a similar situation, so we want to go out and do it again. So and it's very funny because they're all very aware of, you know, perhaps the lunacy of doing it, the fact that they are old, the fact they haven't played a lot of these songs for a long time, the fact they're not quite in shape, the fact that a lot of people who they're going to go and sing to might not think that the message that they're putting out is entirely to their liking. I mean, remember what happened to the Dixie Chicks when the Dixie Chicks said, you know, we're ashamed that George Bush is from our state and were blackballed across country and western radio stations. Terrible. In fact, it was a very interesting documentary about that. Anyway, let's hear a clip. One of the things they decided to do was to go on to and to take this guy, Michael Serra, I think is how you pronounce his name, and he's an ABC journalist who is embedded with the troops in Iraq, and he's, you know, covered do you know him? Are you familiar with his work?
I'm not familiar with his work, I'm not familiar with him either.
No, fine, but apparently he's a well-respected journalist. So they said, well, come on, why don't you become embedded on the tour bus? Why don't you do the documentary side of it? You know, I will look after all the playing and thing, and you can effectively come along with us and see how it goes down. And they get to Atlanta, right? And once they're in the South, they start off in kind of the home territories when everybody, you can do whatever you want, you can burn the flag and everyone's fine, yeah, right, smash the state, all that sort of stuff. But then they get into the southern states and they think it's going, and this is a beautiful clip of Michael, the reporter, reporting on what happened when they played this particular southern states gig. Listen, because it's just a wonderfully comic moment. Here we go.
Towards the end of the show, most of my reporter's expectations of some negative feedback were overshadowed by the Atlantans' enthusiasm for the mix of classics and new music, much like previous audiences.
Woo! I told them they had a sense of humor here in Georgia.
Well, it got a standing ovation from me, frankly. It's just, it's a marvellous moment.
So they're all booing and
well, what's happened is the crowd is completely divided. Up until that point, they've been doing the whole gig is right, anti-George Bush, anti-war, but nobody really notices. What they're listening to is the oldies, and it's, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, you know, it's the Womble and the Hobbit and the Troll, right? And they're all, ning, 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 a bird of peace. And then he says, I knew you all had a sense of humour, and they sing, let's impeach the president. And suddenly, everyone's standing up, and half of them are shouting, get off, communists! And the other half shouting, yes! And then people start storming. And it's very funny, because one of the problems with most concert videos, I mean, like, if you look, for example, at that film of U2, which is just... You know, oh, yeah, you
yeah,
too.
Yeah, we you know.
Yeah, the great, no, look, seriously, Bonio, no, he's got some issues to talk about. Okay, everyone be quiet. He's going to set. He's going to light a little fire on stage. Cause no, really, he knows the Dalai Lama and the Pope. You know, it's great. But the thing with the Neil Young film is...
Why do you come out all kind of received pronunciation there?
Because that's what the way people talk about Bonio, that kind of sanctimonious, boring, humourless, you know, no, really... And, but in the case of Neil Young, he does appear to have a real sense of humour. And there is something hilariously funny about this group playing this song. And literally half the audience are storming out and they're swearing at the cameras. And they've got this news guy in to cover it. And I have to say, I really, really enjoyed the film. I mean, it loses its way to some extent in the final half an hour. But there's a good hour of it, which is rip-roaring, exciting stuff. And when they first start playing the song, so they haven't played together for a very long time... They can't play very well. And there's a couple of things in it in which they start playing a song, they forget the words, they get it all messed up. But as they kind of gather momentum, they get better and better. And I think it's a really good, exciting warts and all documentary. And once again, it's yet another reason to take Neil Young to your heart and love him, as I didn't in the past, but as I do now, because I was wrong about him.
And is the rest of the stuff good? When they perform in classic tunes, is that nicely
well,
done?
Well, yes, but the documentary is really, it's a film about them going out on. I mean, it's a film making an interesting comparison between the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, and saying, you know, are the issues that were around in Vietnam, are they the same as the issues that are around now? And funnily enough, I mean, I know it's, you know, it's not a new thought to say those two things are connected, but watching it, you think that it's uncanny, the resemblance between, you know, the events and the reaction to the events. And it's just that, you know, Neil Young and that lot, when they did it the first time around, they were 18 and clean cut and had nice sideburns, and they do now look like Tobermory and you know,
Beaver,
yes, you know,
whatever they were called,
and they're all. It's the best thing. Other than Neil Young, Neil Young's still quite scrawny, but they're all. You know, they're all obviously eaten many pies between the last record
for supper
and now.
Erwin says Neil Young is working on an alternative fuel source.
Yes, he is.
He's actually the real Wall-E, in fact.
He's making a film in which he's taking a... he told me about this. He's taking a car...
One of your personal conversations.
In the one personal conversation that we had.
Did he call you up?
Didn't ask about you.
Did he ring you or text you or something?
Hi, Mark, it's Neil. He said that he's making
that's
this film
a new voice.
In which he... No, it's like that, isn't it? Neil Young. He's getting a car, and it's an old classic American car with tail fins, but he's developing it so that it doesn't run on petrol, so that it runs entirely on, like, water or air or, you know...
Cheese
or something. And then he's going to drive it around America, going to all these places where you would have had to fill up with gas. So it's doing a number of different things in this kind of burnish. It sounds, you know, he's mad as a box of frogs, but in an entertaining and lovely way. And he taught me how to tune the ukulele, so...
What do we do next?
We need to do the new Eddie Murphy film.
Per Jacobson, who says, no education but self-made millionaire.
Oh, really?
This is a new trend, actually. Let us know how wealthy you are.
Yes, exactly.
Dear Dad and Dad, and if you see Vassos, say hi, Dad. Not only was Mamma Mia number one, but did you see it made... £6,594,058 at the weekend. Could this be a sign that audiences would rather have fun than bleak endings? As for Pierce Brosnan, come on, it's not that bad. A bit like a slightly hungover Joe Cocker. Kermode, on the other hand, shouldn't be let near a microphone. He shouldn't sing either. Ba-dum, he says.
Ba-dum.
Simon says... Simon Noakes... Saw Wall-E at a free preview on Sunday. Looks great, but a touch boring for the first half hour. Kids loved it, though.
Well, there we go. That's an interesting bucket.
However,
that he thought it was boring, but he thought that the kids liked it.
Please will my cinema in Thurrock note that. One, if the preview bump says 10:30 start, start the film at 10:30, not 11.
Yeah.
Don't play guitar rock on a loop from 10 until 11 when the cinema is packed with kids.
Mm.
And three, if someone says that they book seats and turns up at 11:05, either don't let them in or bring a torch so that you can direct them to their seats. Anyway, that's quite enough of that. Let's look forward to a new Eddie Murphy film.
Very, very quickly, before we do that, because it does follow
Let's
on...
Let's just hang on then, no, before
just,
we get to
very
Eddie
quickly, I want to just mention Standard Operating Procedure, which is the new movie by Errol Morris, the documentary maker who made Fog of War, and before that made The Thin Blue Line. And it's yet another War on Terror documentary, which I know we've had sort of many of them. We've had Taxi to the Dark Side quite recently. But it's a documentary about the creation of those images from Abu Ghraib. And it interviews all the people involved in, you know, that appalling incident, including the people who were responsible for both creating those tableaus and taking the photographs of them, and who were then later involved in disciplinary procedure. And it's an interesting thing because, on the one hand, I know some people feel that they're a bit War on Terror out, although I think that CSN Why Deja Vu is, you know, it's such good fun. You'll just have a good evening, and it is funny. And standard operating procedure isn't funny at all, but very much like Taxi to the Dark Side, what it does, it does a very good job of saying, look, what happened on ground level was basically a sanction from above in a way which was duplicitous, because they specifically didn't write down what it was that you were allowed to do, but people on the ground level were encouraged to behave in ways that then were later seen as prosecutable. And if, for example, in the case of standard operating procedure, they have interviews with people like Lindy England, who of course was right in the middle of all that stuff. And one of the criticisms of standard operating procedure has been that it goes soft on those people. It allows them to justify what they did, and it allows them to plead their case. I think completely the opposite. I think what it does is it presents an appalling situation in which it's not true that what happened was that those people acted aberrantly and did terrible things. What happened is that they did something that the system was making them do. And what's really bad is that people further up them weren't prosecuted. And anyway, I thought it was Sally Terry. I very much like Errol Morris. I think he's a good, solid filmmaker. And I think there is always space for a new documentary by him, even if it's on a subject which I think we have all, you know, learnt a lot about recently. Now, moving on to Meet Dave. And this is difficult because there have been adverts for it on the telly. And as I said, my kids have been saying, you know, oh, can you meet Dave? What's it going to be? The adverts are really funny.
You wouldn't want to disappoint your kids, would you?
Well, again, it would take them to take them to see an Eddie Murphy movie. Can it be someone? So the plot is, it's yet another outer. Well, on one hand, this week you have WALL-E, right? Pixar, possible best film contender. You know, an extraterrestrial themed movie. Okay, and then we have Meet Dave, and the story is that Dave is actually a spaceship from the planet Nil. And the planet Nil is running out of water. This is like The Man Who Fell to Earth. You know the plot of The Man Who Fell to Earth, right? They haven't got any water, so David Bowie comes down to Earth to find water and, ironically, becomes a drunk. Ba-boom. Very good story. Walter Tevis made into a film by Nick Rogue. This story is Eddie Murphy is a spaceship who comes to Earth, and inside Eddie Murphy are lots and lots of little people controlling him. Much like, you remember that comic strip, The Numbskulls?
I do, actually.
Yeah, well, it's like that. It's The Numbskulls, but with Eddie Murphy and a science fiction thing from the director of Norbit.
Right, that's not a promising...
Not a style. Good pedigree.
I quite like The Numbskulls.
Anyway,
though.
I'm fine. Well, let's hear a Numbskulls-inflected clip.
Right arm, all left.
Left arm, ready.
Casualties, Doctor?
Abrasions, contusions, nothing significant, Captain.
Engineering.
Running diagnostics, sir.
Lieutenant Balance, what is your status?
Captain, we had a small gas leak. It was silent, but not deadly.
Did you get that?
I did get that.
That's
yes.
It. Okay, and that
is that the best joke?
That is pretty
That's
much the best joke. There was one. There was one other joke, which you had the word colon in it, which I did laugh. And I haven't laughed in an Eddie Murphy movie in quite some time. Now, obviously, as you'll remember from my previous review of Norbit, which was just grisly and horrible and really a really really ugly piece of work, and I just hated it. And in the case of Meet Dave. I mean, it's rubbish.
You've got indigestion.
No, it's just me thinking about Eddie Murphy.
When you think, you get indigestion.
When I think about Eddie Murphy movies, I kind of get indigestion, okay. Yeah. You know, somebody once wrote a review. Oh, I know what it's in. It's in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Somebody listening to Vogue on poetry, and it's so bad that their intestines jump up and strangle them.
Okay, it's
and sometimes
like
watching Eddie Murphy movies, you feel that might actually, you know, you might have a small rebellion on your hands in your body, and your entire system will just say shut down to it. But in the case of Meet Dave, it's rubbish, okay? It's badly put together. Eddie Murphy's a creepy guy. I mean, I don't care what anybody says. He's creepy. As a screen presence, he's not lovable. He's not likable. He's creepy. You just look at him, you think, creepy, 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 creepy. And in his previous incarnation, when he was sort of mad and crazy and out there, he was creepy but quite funny. But since he's become this sort of family-friendly Eddie Murphy, he's just plain creepy. I'm sorry, I can't get around that. That's how it is.
You think he's quite creepy?
I think he's quite creepy. Okay. And so he comes to Earth acting as a creepy robot, right? Which, of course, fine. But inside the creepy robot is the creepy alien Eddie Murphy. He's also quite creepy because he's meant to have no emotions. He's sort of like a, you know, Mr. Spock from Star Trek character, and he's operating the robot, which is Eddie Murphy, the big robot, outside wandering around, and all these adventures happen, which is not very exciting, but stuff happens. And in the course of it, there are jokes about bottoms, there are jokes about toilets, there are jokes about noses, there are jokes about, you know, bodily excretions. And the BBFC beautifully give it PG for the infrequent uses of mild language, toilet humour and mild violence and mild scary moments. But what they don't say is, and, you know, Eddie Murphy just being really creepy, which is quite creepy and unlikable. And that's the biggest problem the film has. And having gone in, really, I mean, I usually sit at the front of a cinema because I don't like anybody being in front of me when I'm watching films. But in this particular one. What?
You usually have a cinema entirely to yourself. You can sit anywhere you like.
No, I can't. It's all the other film critics have to see the films.
Well, you don't want to sit near other film critics?
No, I just don't want to have somebody's head in front of me. I want to sit at the front. So I sit in the front row, right?
Are you eating?
No, I'm not. What's
the... You just regurgitated.
No, I'm not regurgitating. I'm just talking about Eddie Murphy. But for this, I wanted to sit at the back because I really thought this is going to be... And the best thing I can say about Meet
Dave
is...
Are you chewing gum, Kermit?
No, I'm not chewing gum. Okay, I've just got funny speech impediments or something. It's not as terrible as it could be. It's kind of serviceable. And despite Eddie Murphy's weird creepiness that I'm not going to get over, as a stupid, not very well made, but passingly entertaining for the really, really not trying very hard audiences, it's kind of okay. And I have to say, as Eddie Murphy films go, that is a glowing review. I mean, it is rubbish and he's not funny in the same way that... You know, this. I have a problem with Will Ferrell. I just look at him, I think, creepy. And I do think the same thing about Eddie Murphy, although Will Ferrell, apparently, in real life, is apparently a very nice person.
Hello to Dave and Jason.
Yes.
Pentangle Focus, Dumpy's Rusty Nuts and Fairport Convention.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.